readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm looking at the calendar. Father's Day is right around the corner, and I'm here to help you get Dad something he'd really enjoy, not something from that crop of boring selects. So, no ties, no coffee travel mugs, no sir. I have some great suggestions for Dad's Day gifting. Yes, this week we will explore a broad spectrum of titles that have, shall we say, manly appeal. But fear not, ladies. We'll preview books that appeal to thinking folks everywhere, girls and guys alike. Science, business, history, thrillers, adventure, what's new and notable? Just stay tuned.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz, we're there when you can't be.
For over three decades, the great inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil has been one of the most respected and provocative advocates of the role of technology in our future. I recently met the author when I attended one of his fascinating talks. If you ever have the chance to hear him speak, don't miss it. In his classic, The Age of Spiritual Machines, Kurzweil argued that computers would soon rival the full range of human intelligence at its best. Now, in The Singularity is Near, when humans transcend biology, Kurzweil examines the next step in this evolutionary process, the union of human and machine, where the knowledge and skills embedded in our brains will be combined with the vastly greater capacity, speed, and knowledge-sharing ability of our creations. That emergence is the essence of the singularity, an era in which our intelligence will become increasingly non-biological and trillions of times more powerful than it is today. Soon we will be able to transcend our biological limitations and amplify our creativity. By the way, if you feel you may be aging a bit, also pick up a copy of Kurzweil's book, Transcend, which lays out a recipe to reverse the aging process. The Singularity is Near maintains a radically optimistic view of the future course of human development. George K. Wilson narrates.
There is an idea that can enable us to prevail. Furthermore, we can find that idea. And when we find it, we need to implement it. My life has been shaped by this imperative, the power of an idea. This is itself an idea. Around the same time that I was reading the Tom Swift Jr. series, I recall my grandfather, who had also fled Europe with my mother, coming back from his first return visit to Europe with two key memories. One was the gracious treatment he received from the Austrians and Germans, the same people who had forced him to flee in 1938. The other was a rare opportunity he had been given to touch with his own hands some original manuscripts of Leonardo da Vinci. Both recollections influenced me, but the latter is one I've returned to many times. He described the experience with reverence, as if he had touched the work of God himself. This, then, was the religion that I was raised with, veneration for human creativity and the power of ideas. In 1960, at the age of 12, I discovered the computer and became fascinated with its ability to model and recreate the world. I hung around the surplus electronics stores on Canal Street in Manhattan. They're still there, and gathered parts to build my own computational devices. During the 1960s, I was as absorbed in the contemporary musical, cultural, and political movements as my peers, but I became equally engaged in a much more obscure trend, namely the remarkable sequence of machines that IBM proffered during that decade, from their big 7000 series 7070, 7074, 7090, 7094, to their small 1620, effectively the first mini-computer. The machines were introduced at yearly intervals, and each one was less expensive and more powerful than the last, a phenomenon familiar today. I got access to an IBM 1620 and began to write programs for statistical analysis and subsequently for music composition. I still recall the time in 1968 when I was allowed into the secure, cavernous chamber housing what was then the most powerful computer in New England, a top-of-the-line IBM 360 Model 91 with a remarkable million bytes, 1 megabyte, of core memory and impressive speed of 1 million instructions per second, 1 MIPS, and a rental cost of only $1,000 per hour. I had developed a computer program that matched high school students to colleges, and I watched in fascination as the front panel lights danced through a distinctive pattern as the machine processed each student's application. Even though I was quite familiar with every line of code, it nonetheless seemed as if the computer were deep in thought when the lights dimmed for several seconds at the denouement of each such cycle. Indeed, it could do flawlessly in 10 seconds what took us 10 hours to do manually with far less accuracy. As an inventor in the 1970s, I came to realize that my inventions needed to make sense in terms of the enabling technologies and market forces that would exist when the inventions were introduced, as that world would be a very different one from the one in which they were conceived. I began to develop models of how distinct technologies, electronics, communications, computer processors, memory, magnetic storage, and others, developed, and how these changes rippled through markets and ultimately our social institutions. I realized that most inventions fail not because the R&D department can't get them to work, but because the timing is wrong. Inventing is a lot like surfing. You have to anticipate and catch the wave at just the right moment. My interest in technology trends and their implications took on a life of its own in the 1980s, and I began to use my models to project and anticipate future technologies.
Companies in history have ever been as successful and as admired as Google. The company has transformed the internet and become an indispensable part of our lives. How has Google done it? In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, veteran tech reporter Stephen Levy was granted unprecedented access to the company. Levy takes listeners inside Google headquarters, the Googleplex, to explain how Google works. While they were still students at Stanford, Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin revolutionized internet search. They followed this brilliant innovation with another, as two of Google's earliest employees found a way to do what no one else had, make billions of dollars from internet advertising. With this cash cow, Google was able to expand dramatically and take on other transformative projects: more efficient data centers, open source cell phones, free internet video, cloud computing, digitized books, and much more. The key to Google's success in all these businesses, Levy reveals, is its engineering mindset and adoption of such internet values as speed, openness, experimentation, and risk-taking. After its unapologetically elitist approach to hiring, Google pampers its engineers with free food and dry cleaning, on-site doctors and masseuses, and gives them all the resources they need to succeed. Even today, with a workforce of more than 23,000, word has it that Larry Page signs off on every hire. But has Google lost its innovative edge? It stumbled in China. And now, with its newest initiative, social networking, Google is chasing a successful competitor for the first time. Some employees are leaving the company for smaller, nimbler startups. Can the company that famously decided not to be evil still compete? The title is narrated by L.J. Ganser.
On February 18, 2010, Judge Denny Chin of the New York Southern District Federal Court took stock of the packed gallery in courtroom 23B. It was going to be a long day. He was presiding over a hearing that would provide only a gloss to hundreds of submissions he had already received on this case. "There is just too much to digest," he said. He shook his head, preparing himself to hear the arguments of 27 representatives of various interest groups or corporations, as well as presentations by some of the lawyers for various parties, lawyers who filled every place in two long tables before him. The case was the Authors Guild, Inc., Association of American Publishers, et al., versus Google, Inc. It was a lawsuit tentatively resolved by a class settlement agreement in which an authors group and a publishers association set conditions for a technology company to scan and sell books. Judge Chin's decision would involve important issues affecting the future of digital works, and some of the speakers before the court engaged on those issues. But many of the objectors, and most who addressed the court were objectors to the settlement, focused on a young company headquartered on a sprawling campus in Mountain View, California. That company was Google. The speakers seemed to distrust it, fear it, even despise it. A major threat to freedom of expression and participation in cultural diversity. An unjustified monopoly. Eviscerates privacy protections. Concealment and misdirection. Price fixing. A massive market distortion. Preying on the desperate. May well be a per se violation of the antitrust laws. That last statement held special weight, as it came from the U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General. But the federal government was only one of Google's surprising opponents. Some of the others were supporters of the public interest, monitoring the privacy rights and pocketbooks of citizens. Others were advocates of free speech. There was even an objector representing the folk singer Arlo Guthrie. The irony was that Google itself explicitly embraced the lofty values and high moral standards that it was being attacked for flouting. Its founders had consistently stated that their goal was to make the world better, specifically by enabling humanity's access to information. Google had created an astonishing tool that took advantage of the interconnected nature of the burgeoning World Wide Web, a tool that empowered people to locate even obscure information within seconds. This search engine transformed the way people worked, entertained themselves, and learned. Google made historic profits from that product by creating a new form of advertising, non-intrusive and even useful. It hired the sharpest minds in the world and encouraged them to take on challenges that pushed the boundaries of innovation. Its focus on engineering talent to accomplish difficult goals was a national inspiration. It even warned its shareholders that the company would sometimes pursue business practices that serve humanity, even at the expense of lower profits. It accomplished all those achievements with a puckish irreverence that captivated the public and made heroes of its employees. But that didn't matter to the objectors in Judge Chin's courtroom. Those people were Google's natural allies, and they thought that Google was no longer good. The mistrust and fear in the courtroom were reflected globally by governments upset by Google's privacy policies, and businesses worried that Google's disruptive practices would target them next. Everywhere Google's executives turned, they were faced with protests and lawsuits. The course of events was baffling to Google's two founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. Of all Google's projects, the one at issue in the hearing, Google's book search project, was perhaps the most idealistic. It was an audacious attempt to digitize every book ever printed, so that anyone in the world could locate the information within. Google would not give away the full contents of the books, so when users discovered them, they would have reason to buy them. Authors would have new markets. Readers would have instant access to knowledge. After being sued by publishers and authors, Google made a deal with them that would make it even easier to access the books and to buy them on the spot. Every library would get a free terminal to connect to the entire corpus of the world's books. To Google, it was a boon to civilization.
Readers, my guy is technology addicted. He is happiest when holding his BlackBerry in one hand, the cell phone in the other, the iPads on his right side, the laptop on his left. I kid you not. I'm really tired of being overwired, and I bet some of you are too. I think, as a nation, we're very good at connecting to the internet, but increasingly bad at getting connected to one another. My guest today, Daniel Seberg, tackles this head-on in The Digital Diet, the four-step plan to break your tech addiction and regain balance in your life. Daniel is a former technology correspondent for CBS and CNN, appearing on, to list a few, the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, The Early Show, and CNN. He regularly anchors at the online network of ABC News Now and often appears on CNN American Morning and Anderson Cooper 360. Welcome, Daniel. It's so nice to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. Our country is developing a gluttony for technology, as you say, e-obesity. Do tech-obsessed people see this in themselves, or are they just choosing not to disconnect?
Well, you know, I think there's a broad spectrum when we talk about people who are either addicted to technology or obsessed with it. And there are those folks who will deny that they have a problem, and maybe they don't. You know, not everyone does. And I think that when we talk about that spectrum, on the one end are people who don't want to embrace anything. They don't care about the latest and greatest stuff. They're just not into technology that much. On the other end are people who are so caught up in it, so obsessed with it, that they probably would never read a book. But the rest of us are sort of in the middle somewhere. We feel overwhelmed at times. We feel that it bogs us down. We can't keep up with it. We're overwhelmed. And I'm hoping that the book can kind of cut through all of that noise and give people the chance to sort of step back for a minute, get some awareness, and feel stronger and better about their technology, because I love technology and I want people to feel the same way about it.
So to clarify and just to underscore, this book is not about the evils of technology, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are certainly within the book, I point to some of the pitfalls related to technology and that it can lead to things like children who are overweight if they don't find that balance, that it can lead to problems within relationships, that it can lead to problems with knowing your own identity when you think about creating this sort of virtual persona out there and what's real and what's not and, you know, things that can go wrong with relationships. But I don't want to present myself or the book as anti-technology, not at all. I think I want to give people the opportunity to explore some of the alternatives to being too immersed in the online world and give people the tools and tips and exercises and all those sorts of things that can empower them with technology, not feel like they're getting lost in it.
All right. Well, you were a technology correspondent for major networks. Did you have an aha moment when you knew you needed to detox?
I did. And I think that my wife and my family members would agree that it almost came to an intervention. It was late in 2009. I was working for CBS News at the time. And I went home for the holidays and I realized that my friends and family members didn't really know that much about me, even though I was so connected and thought I was sharing and learning so much about their lives. We'd lost all the sort of details. We'd lost the nuances, the emotions that come with picking up the phone or visiting someone in person. And in the book, I write about being a terrific broadcaster and a terrible communicator. And so I was doing a lot of telling and not a lot of listening. And I think that You know, certainly for someone like me who covers technology, I'm immersed in this all the time. You know, it's easy for me to get perhaps too caught up in this, maybe easier than other people. But I think that a lot of folks can relate to that sort of thing. And so it did become a problem for me, and I needed to step back. I needed to find some balance. I did quit social networks entirely for about 8 months, and I tried to manage my email and texting and websites, social networks, and that sort of thing. And eventually this plan came together with the help of some other folks. And I've interviewed neurologists and psychologists and tech people and just average folks to try to put together and structure this four-step plan.
So are guys the biggest offenders, or are women equally as wired?
Well, you know, I think that I think that men and women have sometimes different over-connected problems. But, you know, I've talked to lots of men and women, and they both admit to having problems. For example, women may have more of an issue with social networks. Guys may have more of a problem with email. But, you know, I'm not suggesting that gender necessarily plays a huge role. I think that it's something that affects everyone. You know, I've talked to moms who have a difficult time with their daughters. And I talk to fathers who have a problem with their sons. So I think it's the cross the board.
And okay, let's jump right in and talk a bit about the digital diet. Give us the overview.
Sure. So it's a four-step. There's a 28-day diet within it. And I don't want people to get misled by the word diet. You know, you think of like a food diet. That doesn't mean stop eating. It means, you know, eat the right foods, look at the labels, you know, choose the recipes that work for you. So it's the same thing with the digital diet. You know, there's a day in the beginning that's a detox day. Hopefully you choose a Sunday where everybody's not trying to reach you. But just put everything away for a while and get a little perspective. Then it's all about sort of easing yourself back into how you manage all this. And I want people to remember that it's separating from your work life. We all know that the demands of work require us to be online. It's not like you can just say to your boss, I'm sorry, I'm doing the digital diet this week. But outside of the time that you're at work or outside of your work demands, as best as you can, to try to reintroduce yourself into the online world with something I call an E-day. So that's when you start going online and when you stop being online. And, you know, thanks to the cloud and the fact that the internet is everywhere these days, it's hard to establish those barriers. But I hope that people can try to do that in their own lives. And so the first part is rethink. Now, the next part is reboot, which includes this kind of detox period and easing yourself back in. Then it's all about reconnect, which means going out and meeting with people you haven't seen in a while. You know, there are lots of exercises and tips within that, too, to just kind of reconnect not only with people around you, but with yourself and who you are. And then revitalize is about including lots of cool technologies, because there are tons of apps that will help manage your life. There are lots of great and wonderful devices out there that can help get you in shape, to help you organize your calendar. You know, I don't mean to, I want people to use the technology that works for them. It doesn't have to be everything. You know, I hope that people see the digital diet as, you know, they can do it a la carte at times. It doesn't have to be a buffet. And so, you know, it's all about finding that right balance.
What's your opinion about the working people who check their email constantly over the weekend? Are there stats about how this having no downtime anymore is it affecting health and productivity?
Yeah, I mean, people are increasingly looking at that sort of thing. And you know, one of the things that I like to talk about is, you know, we all know that, you know, you sort of feel like you're the overachiever if you are accessible on email on the weekends or in the middle of the night. But really, I think what that's doing is it's eroding your strength within a company or within your workplace, because it means that you are available any old time. And what happens is that people end up sort of preying on that, especially bosses who think, well, great, now I can get in touch with this person anytime I want. So within the book, I try to give people reasons and a rationale to create these barriers, because no one else is going to do it for you. And so deciding on the weekends that you're going to check email, maybe you can read your email on the weekends but not respond, or just not check it at all until one time, maybe late on Sunday, if that's how you really feel about it. And, you know, sending out that message to people that you're not always available, that you're not always at their beck and call, and trying to focus on the immediate sphere of people and things that are right around, not overextending yourself. And I know that that's easier said than done. And believe me, I've been very much caught up in this world. But there are so many benefits to be gained from establishing that stronger position for yourself.
Let's talk emotionally for a moment. I I myself have been in a situation where someone I'm with, we're watching an event, and they spend more time sending pictures of that event to people around the world than actually interacting with, you know, the person they're with. I mean, that can be very hurtful. What's your advice for that?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, live your life in the real world, not the virtual one. So, you know, enjoy the experiences around you without having to worry about posting them on Facebook or Twitter. You know, they'll still have happened, even if you haven't told everyone about them on your social networks. But, you know, I try to tell people no tech turds is one of my favorite ones. Don't just throw your devices out on the table when you're sitting at a restaurant or something. That sends a message that that person is not as interesting as any flashing light that comes into your device. You know, at any moment in the lull in the conversation, you're going to look at your phone. If you have to have it out, if you need to have access to it, then tell the person why. You know, acknowledge why it's there. Otherwise, put it away. You know, I think we can all survive for, you know, an hour or something without checking all of these things. But we've kind of got lost in that. And we've forgotten that our lives will carry on, even if we're not checking everything every minute.
And even in a business lunch, do you think it's important and the correct etiquette to put the phone and the BlackBerry away?
I think it's even more appropriate to do it at a business lunch, because why else would you go for lunch with these people? I mean, they're supposed to be interested. You're supposed to have something to say, to discuss. You know, have it with those people. If you've got to get in touch with someone else on your phone at another time, then do it afterwards or do it before. But, you know, carve out those conversations and those moments, that face-to-face time that really is so meaningful and powerful.
I love one thing that you, what question that you rose in, that you brought up in the book is, why should a ringing cell phone trump everything else? Can you address what is proper cell phone etiquette and the right way to kind of gently say, you know, hey, I'm here, talk to me?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that it all depends on whether you're expecting an important phone call. Of course, it depends who's around you. But, you know, just acknowledging and discussing this sort of thing, I think, goes a long way in terms of social etiquette with devices. Not just picking it up and start talking on it, or not just picking it up and start texting on it. You know, giving the person who's with you some credit for being there and being around you, and not just detaching yourself and disconnecting from that immediate world and suddenly jumping into your device. So, you know, that's sort of the basic amount of advice, and I think that it can go a long way.
Well, do you think that there's hope for sort of solving this problem, or is it just going to spread and get worse?
I think there's absolutely hope. My belief is that the human condition and humanity can find a way to have a good relationship with their technology. But, you know, that's all I'm hoping for, is that people will get some awareness. This discussion will kind of start to bubble up. And I think that it's increasingly an important sort of thing for people to think about.
And have you been addressing, like, corporate groups? Are they accepting of this book?
They are. I mean, I've started to address different corporate groups, and I hope to do more of that.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I'm certainly a believer in what I read in your book.
Thanks so much, Elaine. I appreciate it.
All right. See you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to shake it up a little bit here. Are you familiar with the work of Richard Dawkins? He's a very famous British evolutionary biologist, atheist, humanist, and author. He is well known for his criticism of creationism. On his official website, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, Dawkins lists his mission as, quote, support scientific education, critical thinking, and evidence-based understanding of the natural world in the quest to overcome religious fundamentalism, superstition, intolerance, and human suffering. Okay. Dawkins is an emeritus fellow of New College, Oxford, and was the University of Oxford's professor for public understanding of science from 1995 until 2008. In his classic volume, The Selfish Gene, recently released as an audio title, Dawkins explains how the selfish gene can also be a subtle gene. The world of the selfish gene revolves around savage competition, ruthless exploitation, and deceit. Yet, acts of apparent altruism do exist in nature. Bees, for example, will commit suicide when they sting to protect the hive, and birds will risk their lives to warn the flock of an approaching hawk. Dawkins' brilliant reformulation of the theory of natural selection has the distinction of having provoked as much excitement and interest outside the scientific community as within it. His theories have had major impact on the study of social biology. If you aren't familiar with Dawkins, now's the time. The book is read by the author and his wife, Lalla Ward.
Intelligent life on a planet comes of age when it first works out the reason for its own existence. If superior creatures from space ever visit Earth, the first question they will ask, in order to assess the level of our civilization, is, have they discovered evolution yet? Living organisms had existed on Earth without ever knowing why for over 3,000 million years before the truth finally dawned on one of them. His name was Charles Darwin. To be fair, others had had inklings of the truth, but it was Darwin who first put together a coherent and tenable account of why we exist. Darwin made it possible for us to give a sensible answer to the curious child whose question heads this chapter. We no longer have to resort to superstition when faced with the deep problems. Is there a meaning to life? What are we for? What is man? After posing the last of these questions, the eminent zoologist G.G. Simpson put it thus.
The point I want to make now is that all attempts to answer that question before 1859 are worthless, and that we will be better off if we ignore them completely.
End note. Some people, even non-religious people, have taken offence at this quotation. I agree that at first it sounds terribly philistine and gauche and intolerant, a bit like Henry Ford's history is more or less bunk. But religious answers apart, I am familiar with them, save your stamp. When you are actually challenged to think of pre-Darwinian answers to the questions, what is man, is there a meaning to life, what are we for, can you, as a matter of fact, think of any that are not now worthless, except for their considerable historic interest? There is such a thing as being just plain wrong, and that is what, before 1859, all answers to those questions were.
Today, the theory of evolution is about as much open to doubt as the theory that the Earth goes round the sun. But the full implications of Darwin's revolution have yet to be widely realised. Zoology is still a minority subject in universities, and even those who choose to study it often make their decision without appreciating its profound philosophical significance. Philosophy, and the subjects known as humanities, are still taught almost as if Darwin had never lived. No doubt this will change in time. In any case, this book is not intended as a general advocacy of Darwinism. Instead, it will explore the consequences of the evolution theory for a particular issue. Its purpose is to examine the biology of selfishness and altruism.
Apart from its academic interest, the human importance of this subject is obvious. It touches every aspect of our social lives, our loving and hating, fighting and cooperating, giving and stealing, our greed and our generosity. These are claims that could have been made for Conrad Lorenz's On Aggression, Robert Ardrey's The Social Contract, and Irenaeus Eibel-Eibesfeld's Love and Hate. The trouble with these books is that their authors got it totally and utterly wrong. They got it wrong because they misunderstood how evolution works. They made the erroneous assumption that the important thing in evolution is the good of the species or the group, rather than the good of the individual or the gene. It is ironic that Ashley Montagu should criticise Lawrence as a direct descendant of the nature red in tooth and claw thinkers of the 19th century. As I understand Lawrence's view of evolution, he would be very much at one with Montagu in rejecting the implications of Tennyson's famous phrase. Unlike both of them, I think nature red in tooth and claw sums up our modern understanding of natural selection admirably.
Greater Journey, a new title by David McCullough, is the enthralling, inspiring, and until now, untold story of adventurous American artists, writers, doctors, politicians, architects, and others of high aspiration who set off for Paris in the years between 1830 and 1900. After risking the hazardous journey across the Atlantic, these Americans embarked on a greater journey in the City of Light. Most had never left home, never experienced a different culture. None had any guarantee of success. That they achieved so much for themselves in their country profoundly altered American history. As McCullough writes, not all pioneers went west. Nearly all of the Americans profiled here, including James Fenimore Cooper, Mark Twain, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Harriet Beecher Stowe, whatever their troubles learning French, their spells of homesickness, and their suffering in raw, cold winters, spent many of the happiest days and nights of their lives in Paris. McCullough tells a sweeping, fascinating story, bringing us into the lives of remarkable men and women. Edward Herman narrates.
Morse had painted Lafayette's portrait for the city of New York, and a visit to Emma Willard's school at Troy had been a high point of Lafayette's tour of the Hudson Valley. All three openly adored the old hero, and the desire to see him again had figured in each of their decisions to sail for France. Cooper had departed well ahead of the others in 1826 when he was 37, and had taken with him his wife and five children, ranging in age from 2 to 13, as well as a 16-year-old nephew. For a whole family to brave the North Atlantic in that day was highly unusual, and especially with children so young. My dear mother was rather alarmed at the idea, the oldest of them, Sue, would remember. According to Cooper, they were bound for Europe in the hope of improving his health. His stomach and spleen had got entirely out of trim, but also to benefit the children's education. As their ship set sail from New York, a man on board a passing vessel, recognizing Cooper, called out, "How long do you mean to be absent?" "5 years," Cooper answered. "You will never come back," the man shouted. It was an exchange Cooper was never to forget. Morse, who had suffered the sudden death of his wife, sailed alone in 1829, at age 38, leaving his three young children in the care of relatives. Emma Hart Willard, a widow in her late 40s, was setting off in spite of the common understanding that the rigors of a voyage at sea were unsuitable for a woman of refinement, unless unavoidable, and certainly not without an appropriate companion. She, however, saw few limitations to what a woman could do and had built her career on the premise. Her doctor had urged the trip in response to a spell of poor health. Sea air had long been understood to have a great curative effect for almost anything that ailed one. But it would seem she needed little persuading. In addition to establishing and running her school, Mrs. Willard had written textbooks on geography and history. Her History of the United States, or Republic of America, had proven sufficiently profitable to make her financially independent. She was a statuesque woman of classic features. A Roman nose gave her a particularly strong profile. And in her role as a schoolmistress, she dressed invariably in the finest black silk or satin, her head crowned with a white turban. She was a splendid-looking woman then in her prime, and fully realized my idea of a queen, remembered one of her students. Do your best, and your best will be growing better, Mrs. Willard was fond of telling them. Leaving the school in the care of her sister, she boarded her ship for France, accompanied by her 20-year-old son, John, ready to face whatever lay ahead. To see Europe at long last, to expand her knowledge that way, was her life's wish, and she was determined to take in all she possibly could in the time allotted, to benefit not only herself and her students, but the women of her country. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Wendell as he was known, was also going in serious pursuit of learning. A graduate of Harvard and a poet, he had already attained fame with his Old Ironsides, a poetic tribute to the USS Constitution that had helped save the historic ship from the scrap heap. I tear her tattered ensign down, long has it waved on high, and many an eye has danced to see that banner in the sky. Beneath it rung the battle shout and burst the cannon's roar. The meteor of the ocean air shall sweep the clouds no more. He had tasted the intoxicating pleasure of authorship, as he would write, but feeling unsuited for a literary life only, He had tried law school for a year, then switched to medicine. It was to complete his medical training that he, with several other young men from Boston, set off for Paris, then widely regarded as the world's leading center of medicine and medical training. Among the others were James Jackson, Jr. and Jonathan Mason Warren, the sons of Boston's two most prominent physicians, James Jackson and John Collins Warren, who had founded the Massachusetts General Hospital. For both these young men, going to Paris was as much the heart's desire of their fathers as it was their own.
I was watching The Daily Show recently, and author Annie Jacobson was on, speaking about her new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Wow. Myths and hypotheses about Area 51 have long abounded, thanks to the intense secrecy enveloping it. Some claim it's home to aliens, underground tunnel systems, and nuclear facilities. Others believe that the lunar landing was actually filmed there. The prevalence of these rumors stems from the fact that no credible insider has ever divulged the truth about his time inside the base. Until now. Annie Jacobson tells the story. She has had exclusive access to 20 men who served on the base secretly for decades, and now they're aged 75 to 92. She also had unprecedented access to 55 additional military and intelligence personnel, scientists, pilots, and engineers linked to the secret base. Area 51 shows us what has really happened in the Nevada desert, from testing nuclear weapons to building super-secret supersonic jets to pursuing the war on terror. This is the first book based on interviews with eyewitnesses to the history of Area 51. It's filled with formerly classified information that has never been accurately decoded for the public. Area 51 weaves the mysterious activities of the top secret base into a gripping narrative, showing that fact is often more fantastic than fiction. The book is read by the author.
To understand how black projects began and how they continue to function today, one must start with the creation of the atomic bomb. The men who ran the Manhattan Project wrote the rules about black operations. The atomic bomb was the mother of all black projects, and it is the parent from which all black operations have sprung. Building the bomb was the single most expensive engineering project in the history of the United States. It began in 1942, and by the time the bomb was tested inside the White Sands Proving Ground in the New Mexico High Desert on July 16, 1945, the bomb's price tag, adjusted for inflation, was $28 billion. The degree of secrecy maintained while building the bomb is almost inconceivable. When the world learned that America had dropped an atomic weapon on Hiroshima, no one was more surprised than the U.S. Congress, none of whose members had had any idea it was being developed. Vice President Harry Truman had been equally stunned to learn about the bomb when he became President of the United States on April 12, 1945. Truman had been chairman of the Senate Special Committee to investigate the National Defense Program when he was vice president, meaning he was in charge of watching how money was spent during the war. Yet he'd had no idea about the atomic bomb until he became president and the information was relayed to him by two men, Vannevar Bush, the president's science advisor, and Henry L. Stimson, the nation's Secretary of War. Bush was in charge of the Manhattan Project, and Stimson was in charge of the war. The Manhattan Project employed 200,000 people. It had 80 offices and dozens of production plants spread out all over the country, including a 60,000-acre facility in rural Tennessee that pulled more power off the nation's electrical grid than New York City did on any given night. And no one knew the Manhattan Project was there. That is how powerful a black operation can be. After the war ended, Congress, the legislators who had been so easily kept in the dark for 2.5 years, was given stewardship of the bomb. It was now up to Congress to decide who would control its unimaginable destructive power. With the passing of the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, a terrifying and unprecedented new system of secret-keeping emerged. The presidential system was governed by presidential executive orders regarding national security information. But the newly created Atomic Energy Commission, formerly known as the Manhattan Project, was now in charge of regulating the classification of all nuclear weapons information in a system that was totally separate from the president's system. In other words, for the first time in American history, a federal agency run by civilians, the Atomic Energy Commission, would maintain a body of secrets classified based on factors other than presidential executive orders. It is from the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 that the concept Bourne Classified came to be, and it was the Atomic Energy Commission that would oversee the building of 70,000 nuclear bombs in 65 different sizes and styles. Atomic Energy was the first entity to control Area 51, a fact previously undisclosed, and it did so with terrifying and unprecedented power. One simply cannot consider Area 51's uncensored history without addressing this cold, hard, and ultimately devastating truth. The Atomic Energy Commission's restricted data classification was an even more terrifying anomaly, something that could originate outside the government through the thinking and research of private parties. In other words, the Atomic Energy Commission could hire a private company to conduct research for the commission, knowing that the company's thinking and research would be Bourne classified, and that even the President of the United States would not necessarily have a need to know about it. In 1994, for instance, when President Clinton created, by executive order, the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments to look into secrets kept by the Atomic Energy Commission, certain records involving certain programs inside and around Area 51 were kept from the president on the grounds that he did not have a need to know.
Dads love adventure. For nearly 50 years, best-selling author Wilbur Smith has thrilled readers with adventure novels. His newest title, Those in Peril, takes on the violent, ruthless world of 21st century piracy. Hazel Bannock is heir to the Bannock Oil Corporation, one of the major global oil producers. While cruising the Indian Ocean, her yacht is hijacked by Somalian pirates, and her 19-year-old daughter Kayla is kidnapped. The pirates demand a crippling $20 billion ransom for her release. With growing evidence of the horrific torture that Kayla is being subjected to, Hazel calls on Hector Cross to rescue her daughter. Hector is the man between Crossbow Security, the company contracted to Bannock Oil to provide all their protection. Between them, Hazel and Hector are determined to take the law into their own hands. Wilbur Smith has been called one of the greatest adventure writers in the world, and Those in Peril enhances that reputation. The tale is read by Rupert Degas.
The earlier images of her were on the center court of Wimbledon being beaten in a hard-fought quarter-final match by Navratilova, or 3 years later accepting the trophy for the women's singles at the Australian Open in Sydney. Then, a year later, came her marriage to Henry Bannock, the head of Bannock Oil, a flamboyant billionaire tycoon 31 years her senior. After that came images of her and her husband chatting and laughing with heads of state or with film stars and other show business personalities, shooting pheasant at Sandringham as the guests of Her Majesty and Prince Philip, or holidaying in the Caribbean on their yacht, the Amorous Dolphin. Then there were clips of her sitting beside her husband on the podium at the annual general meeting of the company. Other clips of her fencing skillfully with Larry King on his talk show. Much later, she was wearing widow's weeds and holding the hand of her lovely young daughter as they watched Henry Bannock's sarcophagus being installed in the mausoleum on his ranch in the Colorado Mountains. After that, her battle with the shareholders and banks and her particularly venomous stepson was gleefully chronicled by business media around the world. When at last she succeeded in wresting the rights that she had inherited from Henry out of the grasping fingers of her stepson, and she took her husband's place at the head of the board of Bannock Oil. The price of Bannock shares plummeted steeply. The investors evaporated. The bank loans dried up. Nobody wanted to bet on a sometime tennis player come society glamour girl turned oil baroness. But they had not taken into account her innate business acumen or the years of her tutelage under Henry Bannock, which were worth 100 MBA degrees. Like the crowds at the Roman circus, her detractors and critics waited in grisly anticipation for her to be devoured by the lions. Then, to the chagrin of all, she brought in the Zara number 8. Forbes magazine blazoned the image of Hazel in white tennis kit holding a racket in her right hand on its front cover. The headline read, "Hazel Bannock aces the opposition. The richest oil strike for the last 60 years. She takes on the mantle of her husband, Henry the Great." The main article began. In the bleak hinterland of a godforsaken and impoverished little emirate named Abu Zara lies an oil concession once owned by Shell. The field had been pumped dry and abandoned in the period directly after World War II. For almost 60 years, it had lain forgotten. That was until Mrs. Hazel Bannock came on the scene. She picked up the concession for a few paltry millions of dollars, and the pundits nudged each other and smirked. Ignoring the protests of her advisers, she spent many millions more in sinking a rotary cone drill into a tiny subterranean anomaly at the northern extremity of the field. An anomaly which, with the primitive exploration techniques of 60 years previously, had been reckoned to be an ancillary of the main reservoir. The geologists of that time had agreed that any oil contained in this area had long ago drained into the main reservoir and been pumped to the surface, leaving the entire field dry and worthless. However, when Mrs. Bannock's drill pierced the impervious salt dome of the diapir, a vast subterranean chamber in which the oil deposits had been trapped, the gas overpressure roared up through the drill hole with such force that it ejected almost 8 kilometers of steel drill string like toothpaste from the tube, and the hole blew out. High-grade crude oil spurted hundreds of feet into the air. At last it became evident that the old Zara numbers 1-7 fields, which had been abandoned by Shell, were only a fraction of the total reserves. The new reservoir lay at a depth of 21,866 feet and held estimated reserves of 5 billion barrels of sweet and light crude. As the helicopter touched down, the flight engineer dropped the landing ladder and dismounted, then reached up to his illustrious passenger. She ignored his proffered hand and jumped the 4 feet to the ground, landing as lightly as the leopard that she so much resembled.
Dad loves to travel, or just likes a good laugh, here's a title to consider. The Dark Tourist, Sightseeing in the World's Most Unlikely Holiday Destinations by Dom Jolie. Jolie is a British TV comedian and journalist, famous for his edgy, offbeat TV shows. He's also an award-winning travel writer for both the Sunday Times and the Mail on Sunday. In this brilliantly odd and hilariously told travel memoir, Jolie sets out on a quest to visit those destinations from which the average tourist would and should run a mile. His quest for offbeat travel stems from a childhood spent in war-torn Lebanon, where instead of swapping marbles, he swapped shrapnel. These early experiences left Dom with a profound loathing for the sanitized experiences of modern-day travel and a taste for the darkest of places. Funny and frightening in equal measure, this is a uniquely bizarre and compelling travelogue, and it's read by the author, one of the most innovative comedians around.
I went to Vietnam and squeezed into Viet Cong tunnels. I went to Nicaragua and skied down the side of a live volcano. I drove across Syria looking for a cave in which I'd scratched my name as a 10-year-old boy. I explored the legendary Empty Quarter on the borders of Oman and Yemen. I drank lethal homemade vodka in a tenement block outside St. Petersburg. I scuba dived on ancient wrecks off Dominica and cage dived with great white sharks in South Africa. I had finally put down my roots. I had my lovely wife and kids in our house in the Cotswolds, so I lived this curious dual life, and the older I got, the more I became drawn to explore offbeat and curious destinations. Something else inside of me appeared to be trying to resolve itself. I had no name for this curious wanderlust until I read a certain article in The Observer. It was about Guyana, which sits on the northern coast of South America and is one of the most inhospitable countries in the world. I once did a comedy show in which I pretended to be a man ringing various foreign embassies from prison. The story I told them was that I'd just won a lot of money on the lottery and planned to tour the world when I got out. I was therefore planning my itinerary and wanted to know whether or not their country was worth a visit. When I got the Guyanan ambassador on the phone, I asked him what there was to see in his country.
Not much really, he answered apologetically. Just snakes and swamps.
The Minister for Tourism in Guyana obviously realised that they had a problem as well, and the piece in The Observer told of his plan to encourage visitors. Guyana was infamous for having been the location of the Jonestown Massacre. Though dubbed a massacre, this was in fact the mass suicide of 918 members of a cult that followed an American nutter called Jim Jones. Men, women and children all drank cyanide at the cult's community in northern Guyana on the 18th of November 1978. The Guyanan Minister for Tourism wanted to rebuild Jonestown so that tourists could come and visit the site. They could even stay overnight and pretend to be in the cult. To most sane people, this sounded like an absolutely terrible idea. But I understood that he was aiming this venture at people like me. I actually found the whole idea compelling. The plan was, the Observer noted disapprovingly, another example of the growing phenomenon of dark tourism, a term generally used to describe travel to sites associated with death and suffering. Now, I wasn't obsessed with blood and gore, and I didn't exactly get off on scenes of human suffering, but I was, however, intrigued by the darker side of tourism. What really interested me, I realised, was that all these places that were supposedly off-limits or dangerous were always fascinating and often incredibly good fun. Every time I mentioned Lebanon to people, they'd suck in their breath and go on about how terrible it must be. And certainly, there was a lot about the country that wasn't great, but there were also wonderful things that people never got to hear about. The food, the scenery, the people. Human life always survived and often flourished under the most extreme of circumstances. These sort of destinations were never one note, and they invariably threw up the unexpected, and that was what I loved travelling for. So the idea for this book was born. I decided to visit six different, difficult destinations in 1 year and just see what happened. I'd finally realised what I was. I was a dark tourist. Chapter 1. Mullahs Don't Snowboard. To travel is to discover that everyone is wrong about other countries. Aldous Huxley. There can be few countries that elicit such extreme reactions from people as does Iran. It's the millwall of the global community. Everybody hates us, but we don't care. As a founding member of George W. Bush's Axis of Evil Club, infamous for religious extremism, anti-Western rhetoric, and being not impartial to the occasional hostage-taking, it's most people's idea of a holiday in hell. For a dark tourist like me, however, it's a dream destination. What could be better than travelling to such a fascinating country? A place that most people will only ever see on the news. This is proper travel, not the package holidaying, all-inclusive, beach-resorting experience that bores me to tears. I grew up hearing about beautiful places like Isfahan and Persepolis, the deserts, the Caspian Sea, the mountains, the caviar. Oh, God, the caviar. I know several Iranians, and they're some of the most cultured and annoyingly good-looking people I've ever met. What better destination, then, with which to kick off my dark tour of the world? I just needed an angle, something to actually go and do there. A trip to the dentist gave me the answer.
I hope you've heard a title or two that seems just right for Dad and you. Thank you so much for joining me today. please take a moment to reach out and send me some of your suggestions of titles you'd like me to preview. Simply go to bookreportradio.com and click on the Reader's Corner, or send an email to elaine@bookreportradio.com. In the very near future, I'm looking for book club members to participate in an upcoming show. So let me hear from you. I'm Elaine Charles, wishing all the dads out there a very happy day. I look forward to being with you again next week on The Book Report.